Well, I'm delighted to have had the chance to read The Last Days of the New Yorker. I was not exactly coming from Dubuque, but close to it in Kansas.
Oh, really?
Us Midwesterners are not completely isolated, and, of course, The New Yorker was a magazine I always looked toward, and then my teenage years, they turned down all of my cartoons that I would send out every month.
Oh, really?
Never did get a cartoon published in The New Yorker. Probably never will. Of course, I don't draw them anymore either. How did you become interested in The New Yorker?
Well, I'd always been interested in The New Yorker, I mean, the same way as you growing up. But I became interested in the story more recently because one of the sort of major figures in the sale of the magazine was a fellow named Phil Messenger, who had been a major investor, and he came to me and said that he thought the story had not been told, that it had been very inaccurately and maybe even worse, very unfully told in the press at the time that Newhouse bought the magazine. So he asked me if I thought there was a book in it, if I would be interested in doing it. And I didn't, actually, initially, because all I knew was what I had read in the papers also, and it all seemed pretty dry. But in fact, it turned out the behind-the-scenes story was a lot better, so I started doing it.
Now, he was kind of your angel, then, I guess. Huh?
He was, yeah, he was. And in fact, because he also got other people, you know, to sort of fall in line. A lot of the people involved with The New Yorker are disinclined to talk to anybody, you know, except their wives and their stockbroker or something in the business side. But so he sort of persuaded other people and wanted nothing out of it. I mean, and I think he comes out as sort of a well-rounded character in the sense that he's not necessarily a hero and he's not necessarily a villain. And I never got any objections from him to, you know, sort of telling it exactly the way I saw it.
Wow, there's so much detail, so many meetings and so many different meeting places. Has anybody faulted you yet on the accuracy?
No. Knock on wood. Knock on microphone.
Well, tell me a little bit about The New Yorker. First of all, let's go back. Just sort of set the historical pavement a little bit. How did The New Yorker get off the ground?
Well, it was founded in 1925, and it's well known, as it should be, as having been the baby of Harold Ross, who was the legendary editor who had before that been editor of Stars and Stripes during World War One. Actually, he was a founder of Stars and Stripes, and then had gone on to work at other magazines, but he had always had this pet project of sort of an urbane humor magazine. And he got the money from a man named Ralph Fleischman, who was an heir to the Fleischman Yeast and Baking Company. And the two of them started. It was a very bumpy start. It was not successful for quite a while, and in fact, it almost went under. And Fleischman gave it an infusion of cash, and all of a sudden, some very good stories started coming, and it ended up being maybe the greatest American success story in terms of magazines, because it's been going ever since, not always thriving, but mostly thriving, and you know, certainly one of America's, you know, great, I don't know, literary landmarks. And
yeah, it sure is. What sets The New Yorker apart from other magazines?
The thing that set it apart from the beginning was the fact that it was not trying to be for everybody. I mean, it was, Harold Ross said in the beginning, it was not for the little old lady from Dubuque. In fact, it turned out to be, I'm sure there are plenty of people in Dubuque who have always read it, but he was trying to start kind of a highbrow, humorous magazine. And at the time that he started it, and in fact through most of its life, until maybe the last 10 or 15 years, most magazines tried for very large audiences, a Saturday Evening Post or a Life magazine. They thought the more circulation you had, the more readers and subscribers, the better you were. But The New Yorker, in fact, took such an opposite stance that Harold Ross worried if circulation grew. He thought that they were doing something wrong if they had too many readers. So it tried to be, it never tried to talk down. It never tried to be for everybody. It always was kind of a magazine that was, you know, written out of the love of the editors and the writers for the stories that they were doing. Nobody's ever had to do a story just to do a story the way it would be at the New York Times or something when they say go out and do it, or even probably most magazines. And the other thing I think that set it apart was that in the advertising sense, they've always tried to have a very, pardon the expression, upscale sort of an advertiser, which they've always thought matched their readers. And they systematically have turned down advertisers over the years who they didn't think were in keeping with the very high tone. And I mean, I'm not talking just sort of schlocky things, but I mean, Sears Roebuck was not allowed, and they wouldn't take aspirin advertisements. Or, I mean, there was just many, many categories that were not allowed, which is not so true lately, but historically it was true. And that was most other magazines took whoever they could get.
It also looks different from most magazines, doesn't it?
It does, yes. It's always been, it has no photographs except in the advertisements. And it's always been, they're just great blocks of type that are sort of unrelieved, which is not the way anybody else has ever done it and gotten away with it anyway. But, and the covers don't tell you anything about what's inside the magazine, or until recently they haven't, which is also goes against the grain. Most people feel that you have to have great zingy headlines on the front of the magazine, you know, sitting there on the newsstand, so people will say, oh, there's an article I have to read. But the New Yorker, they always assumed you would want to read it whether you knew exactly what was in it or not.
It has kind of an unusual typeface, too, doesn't it?
Yes, it has its own, actually. It's they're the only ones who use it. It was invented by Rhea Irvin, who was their first art director. And I think it's called New York. It's called Irvin Bold or something like that.
Well, during the 30s and 40s, it certainly attracted some of the greatest literary figures in the country. Who were some of the great New Yorker writers?
Robert Benchley was one who's probably one of my absolute favorites. He was just such a great humorist. I don't know if there's anybody else. I don't think there's anybody left who writes that sort of wonderfully tongue-in-cheek humor. S.J. Perlman, a lot of fiction writers. John O'Hara basically started there. John Cheever. On through the years, getting further ahead of that, people like, Hiroshima was first printed in the New Yorker. That was obviously in the late 40s. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was first in the New Yorker, sort of set off the whole environmental movement.
Yeah, Salinger, mm-hmm. Thurber, on and on and on. And, of course, Ross presided over the introduction of many of these writers, but then when did he die?
He died in 1952.
In the early 50s?
Yes.
In the
mm-hmm.
early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
Well, then William Shawn took over, who was sort of a deputy. He was Ross's Ross, in a way, Ross's lieutenant. It was a big change in the New Yorker, though, because, in fact, even before Shawn became editor, his hand was beginning to be felt, because Ross always thought that the New Yorker was a place for humor and urbanity, but he didn't think it was a place for a lot of serious issues or for politics. And Shawn very much changed that. He moved it much more away from humor, partly, I think, because when he took over, the world was somewhat seeming a less humorous place than it had. He was the one who had them run Hiroshima. They devoted a whole issue to it. And, you know, it was during the war, toward the end of the war, I think that things didn't seem quite as funny. So the New Yorker got very much away from its humorous roots and got more into serious things, and they had their first editorials at that point. And then when Shawn became editor, he really kind of kept that going. His philosophy was air issues of the day, often before anyone knew that they were issues of the day.
And during this period, the Fleischman family still owned the
mm-hmm.
New Yorker?
Ralph Fleischman was active at the New Yorker from 1925 until really the late 50s, early 60s. And after he was gone, his son Peter Fleischman took over. And he was active there until it was bought by Cy Newhouse. And at that time, there was the stage was sort of being set for a third generation to take over. But that never came to be.
Well, that brings us almost up to some of the more recent dramatic developments with regard to the New Yorker. Apparently, a lot of people had their eye on this magazine.
Always, yes.
Yeah. In the 60s, actually.
Well, really always, though. I mean, since the late 20s, I mean, Henry Luce tried to buy it at one point. There were always people trying to buy it. And, in fact, CBS tried on many occasions. There was a joke at the New Yorker. If it's spring, it's William Paley, because every spring CBS tried to buy the New Yorker. But they were always rebuffed. The Fleischmans thought of it as a family property in a way, and they owned most of the stock, or a lot more stock than anybody else owned. And they just weren't willing to sell, and they were very lucky because, especially before this new day and age of, you know, these kind of hostile takeovers, nobody ever went out after the New Yorker in a hostile way. Everybody always said, okay, it's not for sale. Let us know if it is, and you know, shook hands and left. So that had gone on for ages. But then in the early 80s, it kind of went into play in the sense of big investors who owned stock deciding it was time to find a new owner.
Well, what happened? What made the New Yorker ripe for a takeover?
Well, one of the things that had made it ripe as time went on was that almost despite itself, it became a public company. When it was first formed, Ross had paid a lot of contributors in stock because there was nothing else to pay them with. And over time, the contributors began to sell it to somebody else, usually a friend or someone in the family, but then they would sell it to somebody else. So eventually, there was not a very lively market in it, but there were a lot of outsiders. And several things happened that kind of made it ripe. There was a president named George Green who had been handpicked and sort of nurtured by Peter Fleischman, and they began having disagreements in the late 70s, early 80s over how the New Yorker should be run. Green wanted to be very aggressive about it, and he wanted to buy new companies, and Fleischman wanted things to go on pretty much as they had gone on for 50 or 60 years. And at the same time, two large investors came in, a man named Philip Messenger, who managed to acquire something like 15% of the magazine, and then another one named Bill Reich, who was Messenger was buying for himself, but there was a fellow named Bill Reich who was an investment manager, and he was very actively buying for his clients. So those two got to a position where together they had a big enough block that they could sort of throw some weight around, and they were very much behind Green. And after a series of explosions between Green and Fleischman, Green quit, and that was kind of the end of confidence for the two investors. So they started shopping it around.
And it looks like they found the right person.
Yes, it took them a while. I mean, most people weren't interested because most people would say to them, well, is this going to be friendly? And they'd say, nope, there's no way this is going to be friendly. And they didn't have enough to make, you know, they would go to a Time Inc. or whoever it was and say, we can get you 35%. And the company would say, that's nice. What about the other 65%? But Cy Newhouse, who was the company called Advanced Publications, was the first person who didn't mind putting up a bit of a fight. When he heard that he could get that much of a block, he was interested in getting that and at some point trying to pursue the rest. And he had done this in the past. He had bought companies that didn't look like they were viable, and he'd buy, you know, as much as he could get and then sort of wait till the thing was ripe for swooping down. It was quasi-friendly in the sense that Peter Fleischman, who had been quite ill for a long time and was feeling beleaguered and was worried about his son's ability to take over, be the next generation of Fleischman at the New Yorker, got sort of worn down. And Newhouse's timing was perfect in the sense that that he came calling when Fleischman was feeling quite vulnerable. And he also offered an awful lot of money.
I imagine there was a lot of relief on the both the editorial and the advertising floors that Newhouse came in, huh?
No, I don't think so. I think that somehow it was exactly the opposite of relief. The editorial department, had been very lulled for years. I mean, they didn't really care what was going on in business. Somebody said to me that the editorial department thought that the business department stuck labels on magazines and sent them out. They didn't realize there was any more to it than that, and they'd never paid that much attention. But when Newhouse came in, they realized that in all those years there had been a certain security to the Fleischmans being there. The Fleischmans were very non-meddling in editorial matters, and they let Ross run it, and after him, Sean run it. And in fact, it was an unusual magazine in the sense that really editorial had a very firm hand. I mean, they by far were the dominant hand. It often happens in magazines that the line between the two is a bit hazy, but at the New Yorker, it was an iron wall. So they weren't too happy about Newhouse, and he had a lot of properties that were sort of editorially dubious. They weren't known to be great literature or scholarly reporting or anything. And he had magazines that are extremely successful, but that are much more sort of consumer, commercial-oriented, Vogue magazine or House and Garden, than the New Yorker. So they were quite afraid of what approach he might take.
But he didn't do anything, did he?
Yes. He did, and it's interesting.
Looks the same. It looks the same.
Well, it sort of looks the same, but actually, and it's interesting because when I sort of, travel around different areas, I find that everybody takes the New Yorker very personally. People who have been reading it, as long as they can remember, whatever their age is. And a lot of people have noticed that the advertising environment was the first thing to change a lot. But, I mean, they started doing things. They had always had rules against running half-page horizontal ads. It sounds like a silly thing, but under the new administration, they now run them that way, and people constantly say to me, I hate what they've done with those ads. Readers didn't want the New Yorker to change. But they also have started taking very different kinds of advertisements than they ever used to. The magazine, there were people who actually read it more for the ads. It always had this incredibly sort of sophisticated, highbrow advertising environment, and they would turn down things that they didn't think were, up to their standards. And now they'll take, they've had the Calvin Klein Obsession ads with the four or five bodies, however many it is, it's hard to tell. And they're also running these things called advertorials, which are advertising masquerading as New Yorker writing. And that's offended a lot of the writers because they think that that some advertising man is trying to pretend that he's a New Yorker writer is the way they look at it. And plus, some of them are 30 and 40 pages long, and now they cut right in the middle of stories. So you'll be halfway through a story and all of a sudden have to flip through 20 or 30 pages to figure out where your story continues. So a lot of sort of little, corrupting things like that are just not the spirit that the magazine had always been run with.
Of course, the biggest thing was replacing William Shawn. Tell me about that.
That's right. Well, they were very unhappy about that also. A lot of them realized that the day that Newhouse came in that someday he was going to, first of all, Shawn was in his 80s, and therefore, by definition, he might have had 20 more years, but, as far as we know, he's not immortal. And so they knew that at some point that would be an issue. But Shawn had handpicked a successor named Chip McGrath, and the staff thought that that was agreeable to Newhouse. And then, in fact, in a very sudden move one day, Newhouse went into Shawn's office and said, here's your resignation. I'm going to announce it tomorrow. Please sign it. It was handled, actually, in a very clumsy manner. And
Newhouse has a knack of doing that, doesn't he?
Yes, he does have a knack of doing that. He's been doing that a lot lately, in fact, too. Grace Mirabella at Vogue was found out she was being fired when a friend of hers saw Liz Smith reported on television. And Lou Gropp, who was the editor of House and Garden, was on vacation when he found out that he shouldn't come back, that he was being replaced. So he doesn't seem to be very graceful about easing people out or, telling them in a nice way.
But he did bring in a superior talent as editor, didn't he?
Well, I think he definitely was a superior talent as a book editor. I think that the jury is still
Robert Gottlieb,
yes. He was an editor-in-chief at Knopf. And I think that the jury is still slightly out. The New Yorker really hasn't changed much. He's been there exactly 2 years now, and there hasn't been a lot of change. And whether that's good or bad, I suppose, depends on, it's a totally individual thing. But doesn't sort of seem so far to have a very strong idea of how he wants the magazine to evolve.
He hasn't made that many changes editorially, has
he? No, he really hasn't.
And that was one of his promises.
I think so, yeah. I think when he started, he really didn't, which was probably smart, he didn't make a whole lot of, hard, fast promises because I think he wanted to somewhat play it by ear, but after 2 years, when you look at the magazine, you're still not quite sure what direction he's moving it in. And some people question whether or not a book editor is the right editor for the New Yorker, because I think a lot of people think what it desperately needed was a timeliness and more of a relevance. And I think a lot of times book editors have so long to work on a project. It's not like a newspaper where you have to sort of think daily what's happening tomorrow.
Now, wait
not
a minute.
Just
you point
yesterday.
Out in the last days of The New Yorker that Sean himself would sit on stories for years.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. And in fact, a lot of times, I think the record was John Updike was 24 years or something before a story was printed. But he also ran things as, like Silent Spring. He almost had sort of a prescience about figuring out what kinds of things were going to affect the American public. I mean, civil rights movement really got big boost in The New Yorker because he ran early James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time. He had a sense of things that were going to be important, that were pressing issues, as opposed to, something that's kind of maybe could be run 12 years later. I mean, I suppose it does say something about stories if you think it's still timely that much later. But I think that, in fact, under Sean, it probably had become a problem that it seemed a little stale and irrelevant. And I'm not sure that that's changed under Gottlieb. And I guess the question is whether or not he has the sensibility or that kind of a news sense to make it literate but also newsworthy and, I keep using this word, but relevant, I think, really is.
From a business standpoint, Newhouse still has The New Yorker in its old grungy West 40s offices.
That's right.
He did not merge the magazine with any of the Condé Nast publications.
Right.
So he has given The New Yorker a degree of independence.
Yes, that was one of the promises he made in the beginning when he took it over. He said also The New Yorker employees had a lot of benefits that his other magazine employees have never had, and I'd be surprised if ever get, like profit sharing and that sort of thing. And he kept all of that intact. And he has kept them in the in the offices that they seem to love. It's hard for an outsider to know why, but
yeah.
'Cause they are quite grungy, as you say.
There were some firings, though, weren't there? Some wholesale.
There
firings.
Were. That was another one of the things he had promised. He had that basically the staff would be kept intact, and that was a promise that was very quickly broken because, especially, it's mostly in the business department. But there just were waves of firings immediately within the first year, and again, sometimes in very clumsy ways. There was a woman named Elaine Mateo who was the treasurer, and Steve Florio, who's now the president of the company, had given a speech and said, anybody who's still here for the sales conference in 2 months is on my team, and they're here for good. And Elaine Mateo was still there, and she was at the sales conference, and they liked her so much that she was made a vice president, and Newhouse himself wrote her a personal letter. And then 2 weeks after that, she was suddenly fired. So there didn't seem to be even a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it. In editorial, a few people left of their own will in the beginning, but pretty much people have been able to stay, although some of the sort of old-hand writers tell me that they're finding it a lot harder these days to get published, that Gottlieb is not as interested in their stories as Mr. Sean, as they call him, was.
And they'll probably fade away on their own.
I think so, and it sounds like that's what they're going to be allowed to do, but, it's...
Did you read that 7 Days article about how they would change The New Yorker? They would get
yes.
rid of Ed Mehta and people like that.
Yeah.
And, I don't know who they would hire, probably Jay McInerney or someone like that. I'm not sure. Why do you call your book The Last Days of The New Yorker?
Well, it's meant to be really sort of an ironic title. You can't relight a Roman candle kind of thing. It's kind of the last days of the old New Yorker and the magazine people think of as The New Yorker. It's not meant to say that one of these days it's not going to be on our newsstand. I know that there are writers there who are worrying now that, in fact, that's what's happening. I mean, they feel a lot of pressure. Newhouse apparently he refuses to discuss it, but apparently the magazine is not making money at this point. I think he has very deep pockets. This is a man who just paid $17 million for a Jasper Johns painting, so he probably could keep The New Yorker going for a while. And I think he will, but it's a very uphill battle at this point. They're losing advertising quite steadily. And they're gaining circulation, but at a great cost. They're cutting their subscription rates, which they've never done before. And they're running advertisements on programs like Miami Vice and trying to appeal to a very different kind of reader than they have before. And they've gotten some of those, but it's not very loyal readership. A lot of them drop out when the first year's subscription is up. So I think that they have a lot of very serious problems they haven't figured out how to solve.
Do you think Newhouse is going to stay with it?
I think he will stay with it. I mean, I think certainly for a few years he'll stay with it.
If you could see anybody, say the Fleischman family just had to go, and somebody had to own the New Yorker outside of Newhouse, can you think of anybody you'd like to see own it?
What an interesting question.
Bill Paley, maybe?
Possibly Bill Paley, although...
Of course, he's as old as William Shaw.
Exactly, I was going to say. So then the question is CBS, I guess. But
no, if CBS had bought it, it would have been, you know, they've dismembered CBS. There's nothing left at CBS except the broadcast group. They've sold every division. We've gone from 30,000 employees to six. They sold the magazine division and the publishing division and every other division, including Columbia Records. So there's nothing left except radio and television.
Right.
So if Paley had bought the New Yorker, it would have been gone.
There were offers over the years from some sort of interesting people, like McGeorge Bundy, when he was head of the Ford Foundation, offered to try and find a way to sort of give a safe haven to the New Yorker. And there's a fellow who's head of Lynn Broadcasting named Don Pels, who often offered to buy it, and I think was somebody who genuinely had a feeling for it and wanted to keep it, not so much keep it exactly how it had been, but again, just sort of nurture it. Another person, Bill Reich, was the stockbroker who's actually was one of the reasons it got sold, but a man who just fervently loved the New Yorker, still loves the New Yorker, and always wanted to own it and tried several times to figure out a way. He didn't want Newhouse to have it. He would rather have, you know, bought it all himself and could never figure out a way to do that. I mean, I think in some ways that the best owner, is somebody who's not too large and who doesn't think of it as, you know, sort of the prestigious, you know, jewel in the crown, but somebody who has a real feeling for it and wants to nurture it in sort of a small environment, not a huge... I mean, I think Time Incorporated would be a disaster, for example, but, you know, not some huge publishing conglomerate.
They're not even doing what they're doing right. Well, let's not give up on Cy Newhouse. He has, except for the advertising, he's left it alone pretty well. Gottlieb does have a great deal of prestige, and he hasn't tampered too much with the editorial product. So you've written a really terrific story of a great magazine in flux, and I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.